Okay, thank you very much. I am going to do a brief presentation on a donor survey that I conducted in conjunction with the Donors Working Group on Female Genital Mutilation / Cutting. And before I get to my disclosure statement, just a brief note on terminology. This is somewhat cumbersome, female genital mutilation / cutting. As some of you may know, way back when the practice was referred to as female circumcision. Then in the 70s, it sort of emerged female genital mutilation. And then in the late 90s, there was concern that female genital mutilation was a bit pejorative, and it was kind of alienating some of the communities in which programs were taking place, so it was shifted to female genital cutting. So now the kind of preferred term of art is this somewhat awkward kind of female genital mutilation / cutting. So I may say different things in the course of my presentation, but it's really all the same thing. And I have no relationships to disclose. And just a brief word about the Wallace Global Fund, which is the foundation that I'm representing here today. It's a private family foundation based in Washington, D.C., founded by Bob and his wife, Gordy Wallace. And Bob Wallace was the son of Henry Wallace, who was one of F.D. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Secretaries of Agriculture. And Gordy Wallace was a real champion on FGM issues back in the 70s and 80s. And so we as a foundation are, you know, continuing to kind of uphold her legacy and kind of work on the practice. We give out grants to projects on female genital cutting, about $400,000 in 2007, and we estimate about $500,000 worth of grants in 2008. And we co-founded with a number of other donors this Donors Working Group on Female Genital Mutilation / Cutting back in 2001. And this donors working group, as I said, was founded in 2001, and it's grown to about 20 members or so. I won't bother reading them all off, but as you can see, a range of bilateral, multilateral agencies, a few private foundations, and it's sort of growing all the time. At least that's the goal. And some of the recent accomplishments of this donor working group, the publication of something called Toward a Common Framework for the Abandonment of FGM-FGC, and I have a copy of it. I unfortunately didn't bring a lot of copies, so I can't distribute them, but if anyone is interested in getting any of the stuff, I'd be happy to facilitate that after the panel. And the organization also facilitated a new interagency statement eliminating female genital mutilation, which was just put out this year. Which was, as you can imagine, not an easy task. And then, in addition, the group is developing a website. It hasn't gone live yet. Producing fact sheets and doing global advocacy and communications. And so the broad goals, obviously, of the donors working group are to elevate FGM on the global agenda, to engage in media and outreach, facilitate donor communication and collaboration, and then the issue that I'll be discussing today, this challenge of resource tracking, which is, as I said, today's focus. So I carried out, with the donors working group, a survey of donors trying to assess the levels of funding and the kind of characteristics of funding currently being invested on this issue. The context for this is that the donors working group itself cited a funding target of $240 million over 10 years as its estimate of what it will take to make a significant dent in this practice. And so part of the goal was, to see how are we doing? Are we anywhere close to achieving that? So the survey sample, which again I will briefly hit highlights of, was 20 donors, most of them members of the donor working group. A few private foundations that are included in the sample have not been active, but so 20 donors, again, bilaterals, multilaterals, and private foundations. Now, before I briefly summarize the survey results, and I probably should have done this at the very beginning, but I'll just say, give a few words of background on the issue of FGM itself. As probably most of you know, it's defined as the cutting or removal of tissues of genitalia of girls for, quote, non-therapeutic reasons, end quote. It's practiced in 28 to 30 countries in Africa and the Middle East. And now, of course, with global migration patterns, it can really be found all over the world, including in the United States. The scale of the problem is vast. Some 3 million girls are at risk of being subjected to the practice each year, and estimates are imprecise, but between 100 and 140 million women have already undergone some form of the procedure. DHS data suggests that the practice is, that the prevalence is decreasing in a number of countries, and how that can be determined is comparing prevalence data among girls, between 15 and 19 and between 35 and 39. And so then we can kind of tell, what are the comparative percentage rates? So for example, recent DHS data shows that, in Eritrea, 78% of 15 to 19-year-olds have been subjected, whereas 92% of 35 to 39-year-olds. Similarly, in Ethiopia, 62% of 15 to 19-year-olds have been subjected, whereas 81% of 35 to 39-year-olds. But lest we get too, data from other countries are not as encouraging. So, for example, in Egypt, you have basically the same prevalence rate between those two age groups of 95-96% of all girls in Egypt. In Mali, it's basically 84% for both those age groups. There's a great new data summary set that the Population Reference Bureau has just produced. It's available on their website. It's an organization based in Washington, D.C., that if anyone is interested in sort of the latest statistical data, in a kind of handy, condensed form, I would recommend that to you. It's www.prb.org, I think. Continuing just a little bit of background here, the practice has been, certainly renounced at this point by the international community as well as international governments in both, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, Convention on the Rights of the Child. There's a whole kind of litany of international instruments that have, just denounced the practice in unequivocal terms. National laws in 17 countries have been passed restricting or outright banning the practice. But as you can imagine, in countries where the prevalence rates are as high as I alluded to earlier, in the case of a few countries, enforcement is an enduring challenge for sure. There's been recent data really documenting the negative health effects of the practice. The World Health Organization, as some of you may know, kind of came out with a landmark study in 2006 in which 28,000 women were followed and studied, and there was just unequivocal data indicating that women who had endured this practice were at increased risk for adverse events during childbirth, and disturbingly, that their infants were at greater risk as well, that 1 to 2 infant deaths per 100 deliveries were associated with women who had endured the practice. And so again, this practice certainly shows signs of resilience. We can ask, why does it persist so much? I could do a whole presentation on this, as I'm sure others could too, but briefly, it's of course a very important expression of cultural identity in a number of these cultures. It's part of raising girls properly, preparing them for marriage and adulthood, and of course marriageability is key for economic and social security. So the practice is associated with kind of promoting virginity, decreasing, it's perceived to promote virginity, lead to a decrease in sexual desire. It's also associated with notions of cleanliness and beauty. The clitoris is seen as masculine. Again, I'm generalizing it. There are different, sort of subtle issues in the different cultures, but it's certainly an important part of preserving ethnic identity. And it's also, there's real religious justification promulgated, even though, of course, there's no you know, justification in the holy text of Islam or Christianity, but nonetheless, it's been touted by some religious leaders. So in short, it's what you know the theorists call a self-reinforcing social convention. So in light of all that, the donors have kind of trying to decrease the prevalence of the practice. So kind of now back to the survey. As I mentioned before, 20 donors were the sample. And of course, that's a limited sample. It doesn't even include all of the members of the donor working group. As any of you who have attempted to survey the funding community know, it's extremely difficult to get information out of them. And particularly international organizations where there are field offices and headquarters, and some funding goes through headquarters, some through the field offices, and they don't know what you know they're doing respectively. And so it's very tricky. And again, as some of you know who may have done work like this, not necessarily on FGM, but with the new foreign aid architecture, it also renders it very tricky to kind of track sectoral specific programs. With the advent of general budget support and basket funding and poverty reduction strategy papers and all these sort of new notions of giving donees or you know countries more ability to determine their own priorities and have less you know restrictive funding from the funders, there are many good things about that, but it also makes it very difficult to track funding for specific. You know, initiatives such as this. So with all of those caveats, I'll give a brief summary of the results, and I apologize, this is somewhat of an incoherent slide, but the gist of it is that the money invested in FGM in 2006 totaled $14.7 million and $23 million in 2007. And I should, a little caveat here, and that's it's reflected in this somewhat awkward graph in the middle, which is that because the UN agencies were included in the sample, there was definitely a bit of potential double counting. And so if we break out the UN organizations' funds, that reduces the total of $12.8 million in 2006 and $21.2 million in 2007. On the plus side, when donors were asked in the survey, do they think that they are going to be giving you know, more money in the future to this issue, 9 said yes, 3 said no, that it would actually be less, and 5 indicated it would remain at current levels. And we're trying to get a sense of kind of why the donors were funding in this arena. You know, kind of what are the rationales for the funding? Basically they all mentioned certainly the bilateral and UN agencies all mentioned international agreements and protocols that I mentioned before, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention on Women, also the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child, and the Protocol of Rights of Women in Africa. Shorthand, it's called the Maputo Protocol, which came into play in 2005. Also cited as an important justification for work in this area. Also attempted to get a kind of top-line sense of the kinds of program approaches that were being supported by donors, and that's the kind of piece on the bottom there. And as you can see, they're kind of all over the place. Community-based programs receiving 16 out of 20 donors indicating that community-based programs received support, and then kind of going down the list. The area that received the least degree of funding is advocacy around the issue in donor countries. Very few took that on. And again, I'm kind of going through this quickly, but I can certainly respond to questions after. Looking a little bit more closely at this community-based approaches arena, given that it was the most commonly funded approach, as you can see, we tried to sort of break out community approaches a little bit. So you can see on the right-hand side, different community-based approaches that have, gosh, that's sort of awkward. community-based approaches, and it's like the number of donors supporting. You can't really read the title there on the right. So the most commonly supported approach, this collective abandonment. And this, if Gannon Gillespie had been with us on this panel, he would have spoken about this at some length, because Tostan, the organization that he represents, has really been a pioneer in this area. But basically, as I mentioned before, the notion of FGM as a self-reinforcing social convention, this collective abandonment approach basically, requires believes that a significant number of families need to make a collective and coordinated choice to abandon the practice so that no single girl or family is disadvantaged by the decision. And so there are, again, Gannon's organization, Tostan, as well as a number of others, have been doing long-term community empowerment work, working with communities. And what the kind of distinctive feature of this collective abandonment approach is that it culminates in some sort of a public declaration or public pledge, so that that kind of the whole community pledges to abandon this practice together. And that's a critical piece, so that and there's been a kind of extraordinary success achieved in some areas, particularly in Senegal, with this approach, where a number of villages have pledged to abandon, and there's evaluation data suggesting that it's largely held. So that's been an important program initiative that a number of donors have been very enthusiastic about. Just briefly, how am I doing on time? We asked respondents kind of what do they perceive as the current gaps in FGM funding, and what they cited: advocacy and policy outreach, especially in donor countries, I've already mentioned. The issue of medicalization and treatment. In a number of countries, as enforcement and kind of advocacy against the practice has grown, the practice has become quote-unquote medicalized, where health professionals have been almost as a harm reduction strategy, actually, in carrying out this practice, which is very controversial, and certainly the United Nations agencies and international community is not... is concerned about that, but there's certainly a sense that more needs to be done around that challenge and that issue. Religious outreach, working with religious leaders, work on masculinity and life skills training for youth. Again, were some of the areas that the donors believed were underfunded at present. This, I apologize for this rather difficult slide to interpret. The gist of this was trying to get a sense of the far right column is the number of donors that cited that they were working in the countries at the far right. And then the FGMC prevalence rate was also cited in the second column, just to sort of give a sense of how significant the prevalence is in the respective country. And then, as you can see, the other column is just population, just to get a rough sense of how many women we're talking about. Because in fact, half of the world's women who have endured this practice live in just two countries, Egypt and Ethiopia, just because of the enormous populations that are subjected in those two countries. By way of background, there are 12 countries. In 12 countries, there are prevalence rates of 75% and higher. And those include, you can see some of these on this chart here. So Burkina Faso, Djibouti, Egypt, Ethiopia. The Gambia updated prevalence data is that we're talking 78% in the Gambia. Guinea, Mali, Somalia is up to, it's like 98% based on the most recent data available. Sudan, and then three additional countries not on this chart: Eritrea, Mauritania, and Sierra Leone. So those countries are the hot zones, if you will. So as you can see, there's not necessarily a correlation between country prevalence data and the number of donors that are working in those regions. So for example, you see Senegal, where 9 donors, almost the second highest, are working, even though the national prevalence is lower. Although, of course, in certain ethnic groups in Senegal, the prevalence is much higher than kind of the national. So this is something in future surveys we will refine and fine-tune. This data is a little hard to interpret, but at least it gives us a little flavor of the geographic situation. One, and I think a better approach and something will, okay, I'm almost done. The UNICEF has developed a kind of new approach, which I think is much more productive than looking at national level data, which is divided the or kind of identified six sub-regions, if you will, that they think are receptive for immediate acceleration. And I won't read these all off, but in number these six regions, you see abandonment starting to unfold, in some cases effective law enforcement, laws passed, et cetera. And again, we can talk about that more later since I want to rush through. So conclusions, sorry about the color of this font, it's a little indecipherable, but you know, basically, although investments rose between 2006 and 2007, they fall far short of the amount estimated that is needed. So the donor community is nowhere near where it should be or where it's said it wants to be. The one promising initiative is that UNICEF and UNFPA have just established a trust fund that began on January of 2008 with the goal of $43 million over 5 years, which seeks a 40% reduction in prevalence among girls year 0 to 15 over a five-year period in 17 countries. And they've raised $7 million to date from Italy, Norway, Ireland, and Austria. So that's an exciting initiative that we will be tracking. And then, again, finally, it's certainly an issue like this. It's crucial to link with other donor priorities. But linking these does challenge sector specific resource tracking efforts, and certainly long term community led change takes time and sustained commitment by donors, but the recent example of the donor working group, the trust fund, and ongoing collaboration gives us some hope that we're on track to hopefully continue to help rid the world of this practice. So thank you very much. There is data, donor by donor. You know, you can find a lot more specificity. For example, I can make this available if you're interested. There's summaries and policy statements by a number of the bilateral and multilateral donors where they specify, okay, here's what we're doing in country X and country Y, and this is why, and so that information. Hopefully, again, we're still discussing this, how to make that kind of information available more widely and in a timely manner, because, of course, by the time we get the data, it's like a year too late. So that information is out there mostly. Yeah. Not really. I mean, that chart was somewhat misleading. In other words, it was saying how many donors are active in the country, and so in some cases that might be like my organization, the Wallace Global Fund, may be active in Mali, but our funding consists of 152 grants totaling 150. In other words, a small financial investment. And so the limitations of that chart were that it did not convey the levels of investment. It was more the number of donors. So that's part of it. But then, of course, the donors play a role, but it's certainly by no means the most important role. It's obviously in-country activity, government and commitment, really at the local, regional, and national levels. So, yeah.
I have another question.
Okay.
Also, you mentioned that, actually I saw in your chart, mm-hmm. and outreach. And the interesting part that I observed is couples like that course, we say that one of the things that they see, they need mm-hmm. is an advocacy and outreach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's good. They see the need. The need exists. Yeah, and some are limited. You know, some bilateral agencies, you know, can't always fund the advocacy. That's often where foundations can really play a role. And, you know, so any other questions? Okay.